when you least expect it.
Diane, it's 8:37 p.m.
Welcome to another episode of Twin Peaks Peaks. My name is Ashley Brandt.
My name is Matthew Olson, and today joining us for part 14 of Twin Peaks The Return on the Showtime Network premium cable subscription package is Joel Bacco, creator of Journey Through Twin Peaks, a very good video essay series, who can also be found at lostinthemovies.com and on Twitter as at lostinthemovies. Joel, thank you for joining us
to talk about this.
Hello.
Welcome. Sorry, that was a little premature.
Peaks for this really, I think, in my opinion, very good episode.
Yeah, I agree. I really like this one.
I'll say to preface this, this is the first time with The Return that I went to a public setting to watch the episode. I went to a bar in Brooklyn that's also attached to a movie theater, and they were just playing it in the bar, and what happened during the screening was that there was an old man sitting a couple tables away with headphones on who was alternating between reading the subtitles, since they had captions turned on, and doing bird calls, which I think during any other show would have been annoying, but it's felt oddly appropriate during Twin Peaks. Ashley, I wish you could have been there. I'm sorry I made those plans so last minute.
It's fine. I mean, this is basically on right at my bedtime, so I was doing a face mask anyway.
Nice, nice. Joel, did you watch this episode with anybody? Were you sharing your immediate reaction with anyone?
Actually, let me think about it. I think I was, because I've been watching it pretty regularly at my parents' house, because they live one town over from me and have a much bigger TV than I do. So I've been like kind of nice. I think I did one episode that way, and then I tried to watch it here, and I don't have Showtime where I am, so it was like running through my computer, and I was like, I think I'm going to keep going there. So they're not really big like Lynch or Twin Peaks fans, but they keep kind of being like really game for it. Like they'll come in and sometimes they'll leave like halfway through, but then they'll like come back for the next episode and watch a little bit. So I think I watched most of it with my dad, actually. And he made it through this one, so
nice.
So I guess that's a good thing.
That's fun. I think mine and Matt's moms independently had the same experience when we started the podcast. My mom doesn't have Showtime either, so she's not really caught up on what's happening now, but she watched the whole series on Netflix and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I went over my mom's history before, but they were watching the show live, you know, in 1990, correct? I think I tripped up on that the other week too. Up until actually the episode in season two where James sings Just You and I and then Bob crawls over the couch. And that's when she tapped out initially. And it wasn't until we started this podcast that then my mom started watching episode by episode with us.
Have they been keeping up with the new one, or?
My mom has, yeah. And Ashley, your mom doesn't have Showtime?
No, so she'll see this at some point, maybe. Joel, how did you first get into Twin Peaks? I'm curious.
I first watched it actually a little over 10 years ago. I watched not the first couple episodes, but like episodes, quote-unquote, episodes 1 and 2, you know how the numbering is with Twin Peaks. So it was like the episode after the pilot and the one after that, because it was like a year before the Gold Box came out. And I was like kind of not sure what to make of it at first. It wasn't a David Lynch directed episode. So I was like, oh, is this just like a soap opera that he like produced and didn't have that much? And then the Bob scene came on where he's like crouched behind Sarah Palmer And I was like, oh, well, I'm going to like this. And so I watched a few episodes, and then I realized like that the pilot wasn't available. And I think season two wasn't available either. So I just was like, I'm going to wait on this. And then when the Gold Box came out in 2008, I watched the whole series and Fire Walk With Me right after. And then I rewatched them immediately after that and like did a little blog series that was like my first writing on it, which is funny to look back on now because there were so many. I think I called like Doc Hayward, like Haywood or something like that. And, you know, it's like, it's funny to look back now from having watched it so many times, but that was kind of the first time. And then about 3 years ago, before The Missing Pieces, by total coincidence, I got back into it and I had kind of haven't left the universe since.
That's awesome. Do you feel like your opinion of the series has changed a lot over time?
Yeah, definitely. I think over time I saw more cohesion in it, not necessarily like intentional cohesion, but just the way that things that were so sort of messy do sort of fit into this larger picture. So it's interesting to have that experience where I see it all adding up in some way and then have all this new material come out. And now you're kind of lost at sea a little again, like, well, how does this stuff add up? And, you know, where is this going to tie in with what we've already seen? So that's kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, definitely. What's your kind of methodology for approaching the series? Sorry, I've been really tongue-tied recently. How do you try to make sense of the series? Because I think the more you get into it, the more, at least personally, I have the sense that I'm reading myself into it and that I'm looking for cohesion. And we can talk about like postmodernism and like what storytelling means and, you know, how we create narratives in our lives and how those things mirror. But, you know, what is your approach if you are cognizant of having one when you are working with Twin Peaks?
That's a great question. I think I'm going to kind of fall back on the videos I made a little bit because by the end of making them, I kind of figured out sort of three of the core ideas of the videos, like after the fact. And then I actually went back and made a trailer that I put before them that made it look like I had those questions in mind from the beginning, which was kind of sneaky. But basically, it ended up being, number one, that there was this odd, very odd, interesting collaboration between Lynch and Frost, which is, I don't really see them as, they're sort of complementary, but they have very different visions and approaches. And that's kind of part of what makes Twin Peaks interesting to me, is you have these two different sensibilities kind of clashing, but kind of feeding off of each other. And in the old series, unlike the new one, you had that in like a tug of war kind of way. Like when Lynch mm-hmm. wasn't around, Frost would kind of run the show, and then Lynch would show up and throw everything out the window, and they'd have to kind of, so they were like feeding off of each other. And so that's one thing I look at. I really like that sort of dynamic of teasing out not just what's Lynch and Frost, but what's due to sort of outside circumstances and then their responses to it. And then another thing is to sort of the idea that people had, you know, you mentioned postmodernism, and I feel like in 1990, the critical response was very much that this was like a fascinating art object, but it didn't have any particular deep meaning or resonance. Well, it had a lot of resonance, but it didn't have like a particular, I hate to use the word message, but you know, there's a famous quote that I used, which was, you know, maybe Twin Peaks has nothing in its pretty little head except the desire to please. And I saw it especially through Fire Walk With Me, which I think for me is always kind of the core of the story and the series and everything like that. I thought it did have a lot of meaning. It did have a center, and it did have a weight to it. Both through the themes of like sexual abuse and the sort of the hiding of that and the coming out of that in the community and everything like that. But also, the more I dug into it, seeing in Fire Walk With Me and in the series itself that there was a kind of underlying spiritual message, which I sort of tied in a little bit to Frost's interest in theosophy and Lynch's interest in Hinduism through transcendental meditation. And then the last thing, because this has ended up being a hugely long answer, sorry about that. But the third part was that Laura Palmer and Fire Walk With Me were kind of at the center, as I already kind of mentioned. And that, to me, is crucial. And I think before The Missing Pieces came out, I kind of had trouble reconciling what I liked about the show, what I liked about the movie, like almost like they just didn't belong together. And then mm-hmm. for some reason, seeing the combination of those scenes about the town and the community with the scenes about Laura, I started to kind of develop a bigger picture of how it worked and how it was able to reconcile those two different modes of storytelling and focus and tone and everything like that. So that's my super long answer. Hopefully you can, either it works or you can edit it down into something that does.
Oh, no worries. That's all staying in.
Okay.
I'd say for me, the initial resonance was, you know, coming to it, because I think I started watching the show maybe a year or two after you did. There was a brief period after, I don't know if it was around the time the Gold Box came out, but there was a time when CBS had it available to stream for free just on their website. This was like before Netflix dedicated player
streaming.
Yeah.
That time period, because they also had the original Star Trek series streaming on their website.
Exactly, yeah. And it was like, I think it was ad-free, or you could block the ads. It was nuts. That was the Wild West. People were just like, you can put TV online now, and they lost a lot of money. But I watched it because I grew up, like, you know, 30 minutes away from where it was shot, and that was my, like, initial fascination with it, was, like, this cultural moment that, you know, basically occurred in my backyard, it felt like. And then I waited a while to watch Fire Walk With Me, and I can't for the life of me remember why. And it took me a couple watches to come around to seeing it in relationship to the show. I really wanted to have you on the show. I think we both did, because it's always interesting to get other people's, like, whole stories regarding the show. I mean, this podcast grew out of Ashley and I thinking about doing, how many screenings did we actually do at the coffee shop, Ashley?
We did almost all of season one, you know, which I feel good about.
It was your idea to do it because you were working at the coffee shop. Do you remember, like, what the cultural moment was that made you want to watch the show in the coffee shop? Was that after they had announced the revival?
I feel like they'd announced it. So I think the revival had been announced. We were streaming the series at the Paradox. And then sometime later, David was back on the revival.
Yeah, that was it was a wild period when he was off. I guess the one piece of news we should talk about at the top of the show is in the last week, that Facebook group about bringing David back to the return changed its name to have the fourth season of Twin Peaks on Showtime or something. What is it, Ashley? Do you have it in front of you?
Okay, so yeah, it was this page called Twin Peaks Official Cast Site or some combination of those words. And it was a page on Facebook, and Sherilyn at one time had been the admin of it, Sherilyn Fenn. She posted photos of herself that had not been posted elsewhere on the internet. She was really campaigning for David to be back behind the reins of the revival when he had had that falling out with Showtime. Other cast members were kind of not involved, but were brought in, you know, their pictures were being posted, but it seemed like, you know, Sherilyn was kind of the driving force. And it had been dormant, I think, pretty much ever since David was back on the project. But I got a notification on Facebook that page had changed its name to We Want Season 4 of Twin Peaks. That happened right as this news was coming out from the TCAs that, you know, Showtime had not had any talks with David about Season 4. So,
yeah,
we don't know who's running the page at this point. All we know is at one point, Sherilyn seemed to be running it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder how just this last hour would have changed our thoughts about whether or not they could do a season four, because a lot of stuff happens and it feels like it's both advancing towards a finale and filling in a lot of gaps in the story so far for us. Like, in the first 10 minutes, we find out about the origins of the Blue Rose cases. We're digging in deep now, and we should start in Buckhorn, where we open with finally Buckhorn connecting directly with Twin Peaks, Gordon and Lucy's really charming phone call that played very well in a room full of people obviously.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine.
The long pause Gordon has after Lucy mentions Bora Bora, like, you could hear the people who were there for Twin Peaks, like, just all start to chuckle under their breaths. It was really good. I do wonder why Frank only talks about the diary pages and doesn't think to mention Major Briggs, but that's a minor quibble, maybe.
I wonder if that scene was meant to go... I wonder if maybe it was originally meant to go before they find the message to me, because I do feel like they... this is a whole other discussion, but I suspect that maybe they did write things in a certain order and then it was changed in editing just for, like, rhythm and balance and stuff like that. So it's just a thought. Maybe that scene was supposed to take place before originally.
That would make sense, because it does feel like they're lagging a little bit in their communications with Gordon if they are taking the diary pages somewhat seriously. Because it seems like they've let a lot of time pass before they call Gordon, seemingly.
Yeah, good point.
From there, we get a scene with Albert and Tammy talking about Lois Duffy, two Lois Duffies, it seems. Blue roses, as in the last words of the, I think we can assume doppelganger Lois Duffy, or perhaps the original, I guess we don't really know. And then Tammy busts out the word tulpas, which I think of the three of us here, Joel, you've done the most research into the various belief systems and so forth that have been drawn into the Twin Peaks orbit. But I also did some Googling and found a short and sweet definition of what a tulpa is on Google that we can refer to if need be. This is like when Wyndham Earle mentions Dugpas in season two. Like, it's a direct call out. Yeah. That's supposed to send people to their encyclopedias and, I guess, nowadays to Google. And it has some interesting implications for how we think about doppelgangers, at the very least. The definition of tulpa does have those. It's making me scratch my head in terms of how I think of a doppelganger and manufactured entities, really.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I'm reading the quote now that you put in there. The funny thing is, yeah, I researched a lot of theosophy for the videos, but not only did I never come across tulpa, I actually didn't even... I don't think I even heard Christabel say that in the episode. So everybody was talking about it on Twitter, and I was like, wait, what? The tulpa? Like, I somehow just missed whatever
she
said.
Yeah, I heard hopeful instead of tulpa.
I don't know what I heard, but I heard some other word, and I was like, oh, that's weird. Why'd she say that? And then everyone was, like, talking about tulpa. So thank you for bringing that in.
But it's... I don't have a fully formed thought, because I thought that she said hopeful until, like, 2 o'clock today. But... it is interesting that, well, first of all, she says the blue rose is not found in nature, it's not natural, which kind of reminded me of the atom bomb and kind of linking that to the creation of Bob. And at the same time, this tulpa idea, an entity created in the mind acting independently of and parallel to your own consciousness, is interestingly reminiscent of... multiple personality disorder, and kind of modern theories about the fracturing of consciousnesses, and how they can act independently of one another. I mean, I don't know that that's what David Lynch is gesturing at, but that's definitely a postmodern idea of consciousness and selfhood that we're seeing reflected in the word choice there.
Well, somebody, Andrew Cook responded to something I was asking about it, or something someone responded to me about with it on Twitter. And he said, a tulpa is a theosophist spin on the Buddhist word tulku, probably mispronouncing that, T-U-L-K-U, if I remember right. A thought form being willed into existence. So that's kind of interesting. Because Dugpa is the same thing. Like, Dugpa was like a term that was like... basically sort of like Western mystics in the late 19th century kind of somewhat misunderstanding and bastardizing like Tibetan Buddhism. and like turning one concept into like a somewhat different idea. So it's kind of interesting. And I think it's interesting that it's sort of put into the mouths of the FBI agents, because in a way they sort of hold a similar position toward the sort of the mysticism of Twin Peaks, which is that they're interested in it and they're investigating it. And they're occasionally inside of it, probably Gordon Cole more than anyone else at this point. But they're also not quite in it. You know what I mean? Like, they're always sort of on the outside looking in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think a great example of that would be, not to jump ahead, but the scene where Gordon and Buckhorn sort of stares down that vortex, and it seems like he and Albert have a procedure for this. Whereas, you know, we have our new generation of the Bookhouse Boys just wandering the woods and go on Major Briggs's, you know, more Twin Peaks informed instructions, and they seem to make it out just fine, despite all putting themselves up to getting sucked in.
Yeah, that's a great point. Andy is kind of, and it's so appropriate that it's him. I just love that.
we got to talk about that when we get
there. Can we say that definitively proves now that he's not a corrupt cop? I mean, maybe it doesn't, but I feel like it does.
Thank God.
I think so. I hope so. Lucy bought him a Rolex for an anniversary or something. I mean, my last note on the Tulpa thing is the idea, you know, so I pulled this quote from tulpa.info. That ends with, in short, a tulpa is like a sentient person living in your head separate from you. And then they talk about on that website, you know, these ideas of like how one, if someone wanted to make their own tulpa, if they wanted to will one into being, you know, the thought and practice behind doing that. But that suggests that it's something that comes from within with intention, which, you know, versus how we thought about Cooper's doppelganger, at least how I thought about it, which was that I thought the doppelganger was a representation of possession by Bob, for starters, not anything resembling a separate mirror entity of its own. And I feel like that, of course, has been blown to smithereens. The idea that Cooper, at some point, anyone with a doppelganger, sort of that comes from a willing action in some way. Is an interesting way to think about it. I don't think they're trying to throw their weight behind getting you to think on that level, but it's an interesting lens to see things through, rather than these entities just existing for everybody naturally in this, you know, between these two different planes, you know.
I really like this concept. I kind of like what this is bringing to Twin Peaks, and I think there was a lot of stuff this particular episode did that I felt like took the show in an interesting direction, and maybe away from some of the things that I worried was kind of where it was going. And this is kind of one of them, because for me the question has always been, how do you make the Cooper split like dramatically compelling? Because I think what Firewalk Me did was the Leland Bob split was, it made it, to me, much more compelling than it was on the show, where you're kind of able to get away with this idea it's just a demon possessing this innocent guy. And aside from all the problematic aspects of that, it's also not quite as interesting dramatically to have a character who's just like, oh, he's gone, somebody else took him over. So with Cooper, because the character he's so different from Mr. C, it's hard not to see it as just these almost two different characters. And I don't know yet how they're going to reconcile that. But it seems like something like this is a much more compelling way to sort of start getting into the idea that somehow Mr. C comes from within and not just sort of this imposition from this spiritual other place. And I think you get other aspects of that too, which I know we'll get to in a moment, with the sort of the dreamer inside the dream and who's dreaming it and everything like that. So it seems like the show is going somewhere really interesting, sort of spiritually and mystically. And actually, just as we were talking about the tulpa, I just pulled up the Wikipedia page, and you can toss this in wherever you want or toss it out if you want. But I found a very interesting little subsection before we go on to the next topic that I thought you might want to hear. Mm-hmm. So this is modern subculture. It says, blah, blah, blah. The concept of tulpa was popularized and secularized in the Western world through fiction, gaining popularity on television in the late 90s and 2000s. I don't know about that, but okay. This exposure led to an internet subculture of practitioners who create imaginary friends, which they call tulpa, and believe to be sentient. The community originated in 2009 on the discussion board 4chan and gained popularity through the emergence of the My Little Pony Friendship is Magic fandom.
Oh my god.
These individuals
this is getting right. real other kids.
Calling themselves tulpamancers belong to primarily urban middle class Euro-American adolescent and young adult demographics.
I like that this is citing something that's like someone's sociology thesis has already been about, like the modern tulpa subculture.
What a time
to
be alive.
Yeah, let's not get too deep into the My Little Tulpa zone, I guess. Let's.
Yeah, can I jump off real quick?
Yeah.
One last tulpa thought, and you can cut this at your discretion, Matt.
That's staying in, no matter what.
Just one last tulpa thought. I really should have tacked this on to my comment about postmodernism, but I kind of failed to make this connection. It's also interesting because what's being described kind of in this quote that we've already highlighted, an entity created in the mind, acting independently of and parallel to your own consciousness, is interesting in light of emerging theories of personality. I don't have a great source on this right now. I can certainly look one up, but there are some emerging theories about the psychology of personality kind of indicating that there is no coherent self, just kind of familiar stimuli, and that the idea of a coherent or consistent sense of self is a story that we tell ourselves. And this idea of the tulpa kind of flies in the face of that traditional personality narrative and kind of opens us up to this idea of a self without a personality, a self that doesn't have a set sense of self, perhaps, and kind of the way that we can deal with our inconsistencies by fracturing them off. And maybe this ties back into other theories of multiple personalities, but I think that, you know, the tulpa reference can pull us in a lot of really interesting directions is basically what I'm saying.
I've got an interesting question though for both of you to just mm-hmm. completely like not segue smoothly at all. Is Diane lying about Janie E being her half sister?
Okay. You wrote lie question mark in our notes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was a lie until I read that and then I watched it again and I was like, okay, Laura Dern is actually giving a very good convincing performance of someone who's uncomfortable telling a story that may or may not be true. Regardless, she certainly hates Janie.
Certainly hates Janie, yeah. I mean, I'm just going based off of also reading Miguel Ferrer's face, Albert, scrutinizing Diane as she mentions Las Vegas, because they've already, you know, seen that intercepted text message. So, I mean, again, I still really have no idea where Diane's allegiances lie and what her angle is exactly, but we know that whoever she's talking to, I don't know, is kind of like prompting her or expecting them to ask her about Las Vegas. So, you know, I would imagine like the alarm bells went off in Albert and Gordon's head, and the scene is one takeaway we're supposed to have. And it could be a plant by Diane in that case. But to what end, I don't know, because they could just swoop in Vegas and then protect Dougie Jones. So.
Yeah, I think some other people mentioned it might be a lie too, and I feel like the thought occurred to me too, and I'm not totally sure why, because it seems like it's kind of elaborate and unnecessary if it's not true. Like, why kind of make that up? But I don't know. Maybe it was just because it was sort of such a shock. Like, I know some people actually predicted it, but I had like a faint memory of them doing that, but it just wasn't really at the forefront of my mind at all.
I think the other talking point with this is, of course, like, oh, but if they're, you know, related in any way, shape, or form, like, how perfect for, you know, two of David's,
totally,
you know, muses to be then cast mm-hmm. as half-sisters or whatever. and I appreciate it on that level, but I just don't trust Diane at all right now, so I'm taking everything she says with a huge helping of salt.
I don't know how I feel about like where the whole Diane thing is going. It's sort of hard. I feel like we're talking about being skeptical. Like in a way, I'm almost becoming skeptical of the idea that she is actually a traitor or whatever, because they are. They're sort of hammering it in so much that it feels like there's going to be another twist at some point. Like they've had plenty of time to kind of unveil it, but they're sort of stringing it out. And I think some people have mentioned that maybe she's working for Philip Jeffries, and that seems like it almost might make a little more sense to me than that she's working with Mr. C. Like Mr. C's sending the messages to Jeffries and he's sending it to her or something. I don't know. I could almost see that being the case more.
Ashley, where do you think Diane's allegiances lie at this point after this episode?
I think she's up to no good. I think that's an interesting character choice. I agree that it's being hammered in a lot, but you know what is also being hammered in a lot is the fact that Harry Truman is in the hospital, and I don't know what to make of that. Is he going to die? I don't know. Why do we keep talking about it? I'm not sure. I just want Laura Dern to have something substantial to do. If we're not going to have Audrey, let Laura Dern be evil. That's my vote.
Fair. Also, I guess bad news, more in the news department. Laura Dern, I think, since we last recorded, did not get elected Academy President.
No.
Real bummer. That's right. Who got elected? Anybody would know, or...
Some old white guy.
Surprise.
Some old white guy. Yeah. Whatever. It's still the year of Laura Dern. Star Wars is going to break all sorts of records just because of Laura's pink wig. So it's going to be great.
She's going to get her Emmy for Big Little Lies.
She's having quite a year. Yeah.
We got to talk about these two FBI Vegas agents who we meet ever so briefly, because I just want to touch on how taken aback I was by that part ends and how awesome it was. If I had a quote that I wanted to be at the end of the episode, Ashley, it would be this is what we do in the FBI. But you don't have to take that suggestion, of course.
Yeah, I love how there's no such thing as like a sort of a plain square like FBI office in the world of Twin Peaks. Like no matter where you go, there's some strange eccentricity that the local agents have.
The big ticket item, though, is the Monica Bellucci dream. The Monica Bellucci dream, which is staged exactly like a scene out of Christopher Nolan's Inception.
Oh, interesting. It was very different than a normal Twin Peaks David Lynch dream, wasn't it? Like, just very different.
But I wonder if this is, like, the aesthetic of Gordon Cole, which I think is interesting because in so many ways I think of Gordon as David's avatar in this world. So to give Gordon a different aesthetic sensibility, I think actually makes his character a lot more interesting for me.
I was thinking the same thing. Like, this tracks, like, him having these Paris dreams, specifically Monica Bellucci dreams, and then looking like a cliche, like an Inception, very classy setting, or like, you know, here's my art film. It's black and white, and it's set in a little picturesque bistro in Paris. And then a woman just cries a single tear. Like it was hitting all those notes of, far from any of the dream sequences in Mulholland Drive or Twin Peaks, you know, like I really like that. One thing that got a big laugh when I was watching it with people was the fact that Gordon, to keep up the reality of him telling this to Tammy and Albert, repeats the same lines that Monica Bellucci says too, because it's just funny to hear her give her like mysterious delivery and then just David's Gordon voice just belting it out. The part where it became really interesting for me, of course, though, was when he turns over and then we cut to the footage from Firewalk with Me. Like that was effectively like jarring and pulled me deeper into this dream story he's telling, though. It was it came as a shock. I did not think that that was where it was going to go.
Yeah, the specific shot of him turning and seeing himself actually really, for me at least, like, really worked. Like, it felt very surreal. It's like kind of the most obvious thing in the world, but I wasn't expecting it. And you really notice how much younger he looks when you have that direct cut. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think he was like 46 or something, but he had kind of a baby face and he just looks like a freaking kid in that shot, you know? And it's like, wow, like that was just so cool and unexpected.
Yeah. Again, another instance of this show addressing like the passage of time and aging head on. And then it complicates that scene for us as well, because in Fire Walk With Me, when we see that, it is the hardest thing to sort of dissect, the entrance of Philip Jeffries and so forth. Gordon walks us through some of the major takeaways, like Philip pointing at Cooper and saying, who do you think that is there? Like, people are like, it's because Bob at the end of season two. But the more interesting thing being, like, it seems like Gordon and Albert are remembering things that they immediately started to forget after Philip appeared way back when. And to address that head on and so concretely is really cool for me, because that's still probably the thing where I, even after the missing pieces, feel like I don't have a solid grasp on that scene. But having the context of, like, they don't even really, the characters themselves don't really have a solid grasp on what just happened, was a nice addition, I thought.
There was just so much interesting stuff going on in that scene. And, like, to start with, I mean, it's the most, it's obviously, you know, it kind of leads off the whole thing, but just the fact that he said, and we've all been waiting, like, oh, what's Monica Bellucci going to play in this show? And then he just says, I had another dream about Monica Bellucci. And I just burst out laughing so hard. Like, I was like almost just falling on the floor of the room. Like, it was so funny. I mean, that was just so good.
Gordon yelling that, and then Albert's little grunt. It was pretty good. Yeah,
everyone
was
just like, "What?" How did the bar respond to that?
it got a laugh. But of course, yeah, once you get the Fire Walk With Me scene and you see Philip, you see Dave Bowie, it was like all silent. Everyone was like, "Oh, we're really getting into it now."
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys caught this, but there is an actor by the name of Nathan Frizzell who is credited as voice in this episode. And on Twitter, he revealed that he actually did the voice of David Bowie, the voice of Philip Jeffries, in this episode.
Somebody just really brought that up on Twitter like an hour ago or something. Not who it was, but just that he was redubbed, and why was that and everything.
That's very odd.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he's updated his Twitter since then. I haven't looked, but he did confirm that he was doing the voice of David Bowie.
Interesting. Huh. I mean, I've always been a little worried that they're going to recast him. I don't think they would, because it seems like recasting Donna is one thing, but like the whole point of Philip Jeffries is that he's David Bowie. Like that's like the thing, you know. So I think we'd
even been holding out hope that he might have filmed something before he died. I mean, it could still be the case, but this kind of is an indicator to me that maybe that didn't happen. But I think it doesn't enter that Rogue One Uncanny Valley. Yeah. I feel like the fact that they're still using the scenes that he's in, like, that seems very respectful of him and his image and his estate.
They've done really well, I feel like, with all that stuff, with Bob and Major Briggs and everything, like just using people's images in ways that feel like creative rather than just kind of, I don't know if exploitative is the right word, but like it just feels like they're using them in imaginative ways.
Yeah, definitely. Before we get too far out of this scene, I just want to talk for a second about that line that Monica Bellucci gives Gordon, that we are like the dreamer who dreams and lives inside the dream, but who is the dreamer? Which is, you know, another reason why this whole scene reminded me of Inception, but I actually think it's getting back at that kind of question of consciousness, like, what is consciousness? who are we in relation to consciousness, and kind of like, it's like a chicken and the egg scenario. Like, does existence precede essence, and so on and so forth. But I think it's getting at that same question of self that the invocation of the phrase tulpa is kind of bringing up, that I think we maybe see reflected later in the episode in some different forms. So, well, on the one hand, I think maybe it's kind of getting at, you know, a more literal interpretation of, like, what is a dream, or, like, what is, what are these fantastical realities that we're interacting with in Twin Peaks. I think it's also pointing at kind of a destabilization of self.
Mm. Totally.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And actually, that line is more or less the same line that he used to promote Inland Empire, except he added a bit about a spider, and it's actually from the Upanishads, which is, like, really one of the central texts of Hinduism. And I think it's the first time that he is actually, within the work itself, cited what are basically, you know, some of his, like, guiding religious texts, essentially. I mean, I don't know. He described himself as sort of a semi-Hindu or something once, but transcendental meditation, when you read about it, it is totally an outgrowth of, like, non-dualistic Hinduism, you know, although it's gone in different directions and stuff like that. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that that line is really very much an expression of his spiritual beliefs, which is really interesting to see him go, to be that, like, explicit sort of within the work, I think. And I think the only thing he did before that supposedly was connected with sort of his beliefs was supposedly in Inland Empire, according to Martha Nockamson, the really great Lynch author whose books I highly recommend, Passion of David Lynch and David Lynch Swerves. She said that he told her that the palace and the marketplace that Grace Zabriskie talks about when she visits Laura Dern in that movie are actually terms that the Maharishi used specifically to describe different sort of modes of reality. So it's really interesting. Yeah, I completely agree. I think this is all about the self, and I read a lot of the Upanishads when I was doing the Twin Peaks videos, and I actually have quotes from several of them in the Fire Walk with Me once. And that's like this kind of what it's all about, you know, this idea of how the self relates to the whole. And I think non-dualism is key, because people talk about the duality of Twin Peaks, and it's literally, it's in the title, it's in every episode, it's in, you know, the major plot points, it's obviously in the premise of the return that you have these two Coopers, and yet underlying all of that, I think repeatedly, as in all of Lynch's work, is this idea that it isn't two opposing forces, that the division is somehow false, and that it arises from an inability to kind of comprehend the all, I guess. It sounds kind of vague, but I agree. I think that's exactly nail on the head there.
Can I try a way of phrasing that idea of those divisions, but then the underlying tissue that connects them all? Can I try something here? It's like everybody ordering different sandwiches, but all of them have cheese. No?
Wait,
no laughs
cheese
on that one.
What is it? It's a ref. Is that a reference to something?
That was my segue to the next scene where.
Oh, okay.
In Twin Peaks.
Well played.
Yeah, it's always great when you have to explain your joke and it doesn't go over great at first. I'm going to blame Google Hangouts for that.
I should have been looking at the document.
So I guess moving over to Twin Peaks after my cringy joke.
They set up a buffet in the conference room just to spite Chad before they arrest him, is really what happens here.
It's so good. It's so amazing. I love how Chad is just arrested for the audience without too much more explanation as to what's going on.
Yeah.
It almost makes it that much sweeter. Of course, the real kicker being Hawk, cold as hell, just going, here's your roast beef and cheese to Truman afterwards, but check one box, Chad got his, at least.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
Or is beginning to get his, because it's not even done yet.
Thank God. I mean, I'm just glad we didn't have to spend any more time with him out and about in the world causing havoc in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
There's enough of that going on without Chad.
And he's already done so many, like, it could really be almost anything that they arrest. It could be drugs, it could be, like, the... hiding Marion's letter, or there's just many possibilities.
Accessory to murder, like
just sucking, stealing someone's lunch out of the fridge.
Just being an asshole.
You want to note that, of course, Andy is the one who only orders a cheese sandwich, which is seen as odd.
I did, yeah.
And Andy is the one who, when they walk through the forest, which it's, I think, the longest time we spent in the forests around Twin Peaks in the daytime, and it managed to be both incredibly serene and beautiful and totally tense and anxiety-inducing. A really wonderful sequence. But once they arrive at the big old stump that is Jackrabbit's palace, Andy is the one to remind them to put the soil in their pocket. And then Andy, once they come across the person they find, is the one to hold that person's hand. So I'm reading maybe a little too much into the sandwich thing, but I think... We're supposed to be having our attention drawn towards Andy to almost set up Andy being the one who gets pulled in.
You could say that he's the only one to dispense with the distraction of the roast beef and focus on the pure cheese of consciousness.
There we go. There we go.
You're right. Wow. There we go.
Thank you for bringing that all home for me, Joel.
Dairy is consciousness. Yeah.
Now, why did they put the soil in the pocket? Was that something that was mentioned earlier? Because I was wondering if that was like a Boy Scout thing that I didn't know or something. Like, did they say they were going to do that?
I think that was mentioned in Major Briggs' note.
Okay, interesting.
In
I wonder why.
Oh.
Maybe that's what draws him back eventually or something.
Yeah, maybe that's why Albert had to grab Gordon.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that makes total sense.
It actually does, because
that's got to be it, right?
They don't end up where they found Mado.
Okay,
they end up at Jackrabbit's palace again.
Mark Frost and David Lynch think they're so smart. We figured out what the soil is for. We got it. They go to Jackrabbit's palace. They go 253 yards due east, I believe, and they round the corner and see all this fog pouring out. But just before then, I swear, and I need to go back and like look at this very closely, but I could have sworn they might have walked through a patch of forest that we might have seen from Jerry's perspective several episodes back. There were some leafy ferns that gave me a sense memory of that part where we see Jerry's perspective as he's lost in the woods. And I was really hoping that we would, you know, have the intersection with Jerry and the Bookhouse Boys, and it didn't happen, but it would be something if those were in fact the same location and Jerry was like, I don't know, five steps away from where Nato appears.
I would love that.
Yeah, I kind of thought they might. He was maybe going to pop up there too. I wonder if he's out of the woods because he was in that field. Of course, who knows?
Yeah, it would be something if they rounded the corner and there's that like all that fog, all that smoke, and it's just Jerry vaping. Jerry is the key
hilarious.
The whole time.
I hope so.
But no, instead it's totally shocking. It's the eyeless woman from the pinkish purplish place, credited as Nato. And this is someone who we've until now thought of as like a otherworldly lodge entity person now in the flesh in Twin Peaks.
Yeah, this certainly kind of seems to fly in the face of maybe how I thought the lodges worked or how those spaces worked. It's definitely not clear to me why she, of all people, is suddenly in the world of Twin Peaks. I don't know how I feel about the way that her body was framed in this sequence. And I don't really know like where to go from that comment. I kind of go back and forth as to whether this is kind of in the camp of the return's objectification of women, or whether I'm reading too much into it at this stage. But regardless, we do get another naked woman in distress on screen.
I'll say this, and I feel like I must have come across this on one of the boards or Twitter today with regards to Andy as well, but someone, not my brain at work here, mentioned that the last time we saw Andy interact with a naked woman, it was when they found Laura Palmer's body. And in that moment, Andy started to cry. He showed his vulnerability and wasn't able to engage with the situation, whereas this time he holds Nato's hand as the portal opens above them. And I did kind of like that. It would be weird to just be like naked woman as the symbol to do that. They also, if that was what they were going for, they could have also just for no reason had Nato wrapped in plastic. It really wouldn't matter. The choice to have her be nude in the framing, I think, is worth questioning, but it's also just like a really arresting, beautiful scene. And I liked the portal effect doubly so this time, seeing it open above them, and that weird little stump that very much mirrored the motor oil pool at Glastonbury Grove, only kind of pearlescent and golden. I wonder if this sequence might seal whether or not the pinkish purplish, also black and white place in terms of the film, is the White Lodge, if we're supposed to take it as such now.
Yeah, I really like that idea. It makes me wonder too, because yeah, Nato came from the purple room, and it looked like it was the same sort of structure or some part of the structure that the giants, or now I guess the fireman, we have to call him now, that he was in. But that seemed like a much more frightening place because of the figure banging on the door, and maybe because of her mutilation and everything, and then the fact that she falls off and all that. So it makes me wonder, like, what if that is. And I think Lynch always sort of has a little bit of a different take on the whole white-black lodge than Frost does, so I'd be kind of interested to see how the two of them sort of negotiated that with this. But I think if that is supposed to be the White Lodge, like, what is the purple room significance within that?
I wonder, I guess this thought just occurred to me, and we don't have to go too deep into this, but in part three, when Cooper arrives, we see him outside the pink ocean, and then he walks in, and then they exit out, and instead of arriving at the top of the tower that we see later in part eight, they're just on that box floating sort of in the space field that we just previously saw Cooper, you know, sort of falling through. So I wonder if, you know, like we've kind of thought of the waiting room, red room, as being an intermediary between the black and white lodge, if, you know, if that box that Nato and Cooper appear on in part three is also in between. That's all very much like trying to lay this out on a map, which is not necessary.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that kind of makes me hesitate to join the pink place and the lodge or the waiting room in that way is the fact that electricity is so emphasized in the pink place. Like, we hear it crackling, and that's kind of how Cooper goes from one place to another. And in this scene, when we see Nato and we see the portal open up, I watch with captions on just because I'm always afraid I'm going to miss something, although I still miss Toolpit anyway. When I was watching this scene and the captions were on, it kept emphasizing that there is this electricity crackling, there's electricity humming, and we've never seen electricity linked with the Black Lodge, which definitely makes me question what the relationship between those two places are, because electricity has really emerged in The Return as seemingly a conductor for the soul, for lack of a better word.
I remember now, we should have mentioned, they do have a brief shot of some power lines running through this part of the woods as well. And power lines come up again in a very big way. But I can be down with that. The idea that maybe electricity is well, I mean, we also see it with the woodsman, though. So I would hesitate to maybe then say it's good. Is that what you were saying, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, I was kind of saying good, but I was kind of saying that because of the scene with the hit and run.
Oh, right.
On the boy's soul.
Yes.
And the electricity crackling in the telephone poles. I don't think that the connection between electricity and the woodsman is the same as the connection between this kind of free-flowing electricity and this kind of mysticism that's associated with the pink place and with the soul in that scene. Am I making sense?
Yeah. So Andy is the one who gets pulled into whatever place this may be, and meets the fireman. And I don't know if anybody actually saw that coming. Yeah. I certainly didn't.
It works, but it's such a surprise. But then again, you look at it.
I thought it was going to be our boy.
Our boy Bobby.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be our boy Bobby stepping into his father's shoes, but I'm equally pleased with this.
This really makes sense, and it kind of like redeems a little bit for me. I've never been a huge fan, as much as I almost always like Lynch's what he does as director more, his choices more than probably any other. That Andy was always somebody who I felt like Lynch pushed kind of too far, like to make him kind of doofus and like stumbling around and all that stuff. Like ever since season two, I feel like every time, and a lot in The Return, you get these weird like shots, like when he's sitting there with Truman and he's like, there's no Indians here or something, and you know, he really hammers that aspect home. So in a way, this was for me like a nice little almost like redemption of like, okay, well, he may take that part of Andy too far sometimes, but like almost like only he could really bring this out of him as well, you know, this sort of almost like a capital F fool and like a myth or a I'm struggling for like a reference, but there's something like appropriate about him being the one who enters it. It reminds me a lot of like Grail mythology, yeah. I think, where it's like the innocent or pure yes, heart goes totally into the castle. And
so the giant who will now forever be known as the fireman tells Andy his name, and this is something that people kind of piece together in advance, because it was revealed that the song, the Angelo song that plays during part 8 as the fireman floats up and has the golden matter emit from his head, it was called the Fireman. So not a shock to everyone who's been like reading along with every little snippet, but now he's the fireman. And there's also this, it's David showing once again that he hasn't run out of interesting things to do with reversed footage, because it took me a while to realize that the coalescing smoke was actually running in reverse and was going to get sucked down in. And I thought just like watching it form this sort of tunnel over Andy was really, really something else in terms of the visuals. And then we get Andy's montage, another instance of someone watching something in Twin Peaks, a recurring theme of someone basically like watching television or watching something that can be interpreted as television. And there's a lot of images that flash by.
Yeah, it was kind of the most out there recap show ever.
It's the Twin Peaks clip show. Finally, they did
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it... I feel like I've brought this up before, but it reminded me so much of Eisenstein's theory of montage, and it's really... Eisenstein's theory of montage was kind of what moved film from just being a still camera looking at a stage to using the camera and camera angles and juxtaposed images as a medium. So the theory of montage is that the juxtaposition of two images creates a new meaning that's independent of the images separately, because it's a relational relational meaning. And what we do see is this montage, and while it's kind of literal in terms of leading you through the different points that have already been introduced, like the creepy baby thing the creepy like being that killed the couple in New York, the creation of Bob, the gas station, the lumberman, all that stuff. We're familiar with those points, but it's so strange to look at all of those individual images and think about the meaning that series is collecting as it goes on, because of our understanding of the show and what we already know and how we're drawing connections between the two, because independently, those are all very strange images.
Yeah, and then we're just getting the mashups of them all. I regret not having double checked and made sure that I presented these bullet points in our notes in order. This is an approximate order, but I think maybe we should talk about the ones that are maybe unexpected. You know, we see the woodsman again, we see the convenience store, some part eight callbacks, but I think maybe we should focus on the ones that were that really stood out to us. I would say one, Laura flanked by the angel, two angels that appear at the, or two images of the angel that appears at the end of Fire Walk With Me stood out to me. Cooper and Mr. C sort of phasing into one another was at least visually striking. We see a long shot of Andy leading Lucy by the shoulders inside the sheriff's department to a doorway, and then it hangs on Lucy for a while. And it's not the same outfit that Lucy is wearing later in the episode, which made me think, you know, on first watch that maybe this is like a premonition of something. But we end really definitively on the Fat Trout telephone pole, the number 6 labeled pole that we first saw in Fire Walk With Me, and that has seemed to stay with Carl Rod at the location of the new Fat Trout trailer park. I think it's very ominous that that is the last image that Andy sees.
Yeah, it's interesting too when you were talking about how the sequence like uses images, both in terms of like montage and sort of almost telling a story a little bit. Like, it makes me think of, it's almost like they're pictograms or something, that's how they communicate in this realm, you know? I mean, even though they can talk, like, the images are sort of so isolated in an interesting way. Like, they're very iconographic. Each one is like almost a specific thing, you know? And I mean, the angels flanking Laura, like that, especially with that sort of circular frame that it has around it, the little mm-hmm. portal that he's looking up into, and sort of how ornate it is. It feels like some sort of iconography, or it feels like it's harkening back to almost like medieval or ancient art, where they're using the art not so much as an end to itself, but to sort of communicate something. Like each one is a phrase or something. I don't know. That's just it was a really striking way of
it's reliving it. It's a very deliberate choice, because we see that Laura picture all the time. We see it in the opening of every episode now. And they could have just done the picture of Laura and then the shot of the angel from Fire Walk With Me if they just wanted to be like, remember the angel. But instead, it's intentionally composed that way. I think I skipped over this again. The shot that was so striking to see again in the very opening of the return, going back to the screaming girl at Twin Peaks High all the way back in the pilot.
Yes,
getting a second appearance this episode. Yes.
And in a way, that's almost like the least, like all the other ones are sort of close-ups of things. And that's like a whole sort of little vista for a moment.
And yet that is all you need in that moment of the pilot to know, to communicate to Donna. You know, I think they could have thrown in the empty school chair as well. But that's all Donna needs to know that something is horribly wrong with Laura, that Laura is gone. Yeah. So Andy gets his clip episode, and then
I had one thing I wanted to throw in there was the experiment. We see it back to back, the way it was presented in the glass box and in the atomic bomb, and it does look very different. I think in the glass box it looks like there's another head attached, something kind of decaying, which makes me think of how they found the Major Briggs Ruth Davenport.
It's definitely phasing around in a way that suggests, you know, when we see it attack Sam and Tracy, it's not all there. Whereas it's just very still in the sort of vomit scene.
And the head looks like rotten or something. I don't know.
It looks like, yeah.
Just, it doesn't have the horns.
Even more creepy, yeah.
Makes me wonder if that was decapitated and they keep showing this image of a creature with horns, or at least a shape that looks like it has horns. What has the mother's head somehow been separated from the body, and what does that mean? I don't know.
Maybe we'll find out.
I mean, that also... I mean, if that were the case, that would also maybe be a gesture to the idea of is there a connection between the physical being and the mental being? Like, what is the self? What happens if you transplant your consciousness into someone else's body? Like, that could also be a gesture at these themes of identity that we've been talking about. And I was also just going to add that the deliberate framing of that montage that we see through Andy's point of view, I think also is drawing attention to framing as a device, and like the act of watching, like you were saying, Matt, which is kind of less postmodern and more modernist in its construction, but I think it's also a very deliberate choice in that moment to draw attention to both the mechanism of watching and the mechanism of framing.
Well, then let's cut to Twin Peaks Sheriff Department in the lockup, where Chad is none too happy and he's being a dick. Andy tells him off. Lucy has graciously provided her her nightgown to...
Pajamas.
Yeah, her pajamas to NATO. And there's a dude who's got a real bad cut on his face and is drooling blood and is parroting words back. And I'll just say it here because it's in my notes. Kind of like Dougie does. And then it's Chad's worst nightmare.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I just love how long the scene goes on for Chad's torment.
Oh god. I do want to say this is the only time I've felt any kind of sympathy for Chad, as someone with misophonia that had shivers going up and down my spine as I was just listening to the noise. So I felt for him in that moment, very briefly. So kind of a character building moment, I think, on Lynch's part to make him a more well-rounded villain.
Sure.
It also, did anybody else think about Bobby and Mike doing the dog bark in that jail cell?
Yes,
we did.
That occurred to me. It was almost like, okay, if that wasn't cacophonous enough, let's make it just like cells full of monkeys just like jabbering at each other for like 3 minutes. Cause even Chad joins in, like all three of them are just like making animal noises. It's pretty wild.
The captions on that scene say something wild too, like all gibbering or something. It was, I do want to say, yeah, I had the same association with the barking. That's definitely just going to be the mashup at the start of this episode of old and new Twin Peaks. Yeah. That's 100%.
Yeah, I love that stuff that you've been doing. That's so each episode.
It's real fun to do.
Oh god, yeah.
But it seems like we've definitely found Billy.
Oh,
even
right.
Even if no one else knows where he is.
I'm leaning towards that being Billy, but we need more of what happened to Billy
Having watched it twice, I feel like I feel very certain that this is Billy at this point. But who knows if this is the Billy that Audrey is looking for in, you know, that sense you pointed out that he has this kind of speech mannerism that's very much Dougie-like. And it makes me wonder if this event that they're talking about in the roadhouse, this strange encounter that someone has had with Billy, is maybe an indication of some kind of distress or trauma that he's been through that has kind of left him in a Dougie-like state. And I don't know how that would happen. It's not as though, you know, we know there's another character who's trying to live inside of Billy's being, but it certainly seems like there's something wrong with him.
Joel, where do you stand on the identity of this strange person in jail?
The guy in the jail cell. I think, somebody pointed out, and I didn't even remember this, but does Audrey say that she had a dream about Billy bleeding from like his nose and his mouth or his eyes or something
she totally did. Oh my God, it's gotta be him.
Yeah, somebody pointed that out to me, and I didn't know if they were talking about if Audrey said that or if the people at the end of the episode who talk about Billy said that, but they said it was Audrey. And then the people at the end of the episode also talk about Billy running into the house and, like, bleeding and blood everywhere.
Bleeding from his mouth and his nose, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so both of them say that, then? Oh, wow, okay. Yeah, it's good.
I don't remember Audrey saying that, but yeah, I might just be missing something.
No, I didn't remember it either, Audrey, but they said it was Audrey, so I don't know.
Audrey says she had, in her first appearance, she says he had a dream about Billy. And he was bleeding. Yeah, I remember this.
Does she say anything about blood or?
Yeah. So, more evidence for Billy then. But Ashley, you said you have misophonia. How do you feel about English accents? How do you feel about Cockney?
I also hate accents. But this wasn't so bad.
So we finally get to learn really everything about Freddie Sykes, who we now learn is James Hurley's co-worker on the Great Northern Security Staff and played by Jake Wardle, who I realized I did see, like, I don't know, 6 years ago in his viral YouTube video where he just does a bunch of different English language accents.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I never heard of
that's
this.
That's wild.
That's his claim to fame. He's like English in however many accents, and he does like all these different British accents, and I think he does different American accents. That's his like big thing.
That's so strange.
Yeah, and it's here's the thing about those videos is that they're kind of cringeworthy because he does some accents. Like I think he dips into patois and stuff. And some of it's just like you're watching this, you know, this British kid.
Ooh, you're like conjuring this in my imagination. I feel like I am remembering this video now.
Yeah, and you're just like, this is a little cringeworthy. But he like is trying to, you know, hit on certain linguistic characteristics and slang. And this is a scene that plays to his strength because it's just peppered with all this absurd, in the context of Twin Peaks, absurd British slang, on top of which he's describing a meeting much like Andy's, and we're all just straight still new to this information about the firemen, and he's just like, okay, I'll tell you the story, James, and then says all this crazy shit.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming.
No,
I did not see the green glove being a gift from the fireman.
Okay, you know what this really reminded me of? The superhero origin story tropes.
Mm-hmm.
This was very, like, with great power comes great responsibility. Why aren't I helping people? It's my destiny. This weird supernatural thing happens that you can't explain. It was very superhero genre, which I thought was an odd choice, but I mean, this whole scene is very strange and very out of left field.
Yeah. I want to bring attention to two particularly cheeky lines. When he's beginning his story and he talks about going in the alley and then encountering the fireman and waking up at his own place. The next part he says is, I ran a comb through my hair and went downstairs and had a cup. That's like a direct quote from A Day in the Life by the Beatles. Which is a song that also has the line at the end of that section, somebody spoke and I went into a dream. Nice job, Mark and David. Sergeant Pepper's is the worst Beatles album, I'm sorry. But I do like that song. And then the many happy returns, and it's just like, I don't know, whenever the word that's in the title of the show comes up, like happy returns, I don't know. Makes me hopeful that we'll see some more returns, at least characters going to the town of Twin Peaks.
Who says many happy returns? The Freddy?
I think Freddy, yeah.
Yeah, he says that to James because it's his birthday.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think, too, of the British show The Prisoner, which like Mark Frost is a huge fan of, because there was an episode called Many Happy Returns.
Mm.
Trying to remember if they say that like in the episode or if it just happens to be the title, but I feel like maybe that could be a reference. And that's a show that has some bearing on Twin Peaks, too.
Definitely.
Yeah, certainly.
I've been meaning to watch that show for a long time. Have you seen it, Joel?
Yeah, I did. It's one of the few shows I did sort of a viewing diary for. I've done like Twin Peaks, Neon Genesis Evangelion, I think Top of the Lake, and The Prisoner.
And like Top of the Lake is my favorite show ever.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that coming back too. That's going to be super interesting.
Yeah, I was reading a review in The Guardian that the second season was not good, and I just had to stop because I don't want to believe that it's not good because that's the best thing that's ever been on TV.
I feel like I read a good somebody really liking it in another thing, so hopefully.
Well, all right, I got to watch The Prisoner and Top of the Lake.
I know, right?
Yeah.
But yeah,
we'll talk about Top of the Lake at another time.
Top of the Lake. Looks, the new podcast from the creators
Top
of Twin
of
Peaks.
The Lake Looks. I like that. That's good. Lake Looks.
Perfect. So,
coming soon.
Who do we think Freddie Sykes is going to punch to death with his green fist of fury?
I hope it's red.
I would like it to be red. You know? Yes, I would like red to die by Freddie's hand.
Yeah, I think Richard Horn has to die or be confronted by a much more significant cosmic force, but Freddy is free to take out Red at any point in time.
Plus, doesn't Red talks about, like, his hand and everything, right? Like, he makes a big deal out of his hand.
Yes.
That's a great thought.
Yes,
yeah, I like that idea.
And then James having, after this, maybe a not-so-very happy birthday, has a little spooky scene all on his own in the boiler room, which is also I guess connected to the actual like generator area next to the Great Northern that, you know, I mean they do actually get power from that waterfall. I don't know if it's just for the hotel or if that feeds into the grid at large, but I wouldn't be shocked to find if they actually filmed that right underneath the Salish Lodge in Snoqualmie. But James hears that same hum as Beverly and Ben, and he goes to that door and then cut away. Like, no, we're not going to find out what it is. A little tease there. I don't know.
Yeah, I also, before we move from the scene, I just want to draw attention to the fact that this is one of the most obvious references, I think, to goodness that we've really seen or heard, because Freddie's the one who says, you know, he thinks, Why aren't I helping people? Why aren't I doing good? And then he's told to go to Twin Peaks to follow his destiny sort of shortly after this revelation that he should be helping people. It's also in there is the phrase, you know, why me? Why not you? You know, why not you on the part of the fireman? I was saying this is very superhero, and it is, but it also definitely brings to mind some of my concerns about part 8 and kind of the deifying of Laura as a force of goodness in that episode, or this kind of split between, you know, Bob and Laura that we saw there. So it, I don't know. And what's interesting to me is that it's so cartoonish, and I wonder if it's sort of supposed to be making fun of this notion of Laura as a cosmic force for good, or if we're supposed to kind of be interpreting this as, you know, another hand that the fireman is playing in this pushback against Bob. I don't know, but to me it seems, you know, somewhat noteworthy.
Maybe anybody, any old person can be good. Laura happens to be good. Andy is good. Cooper is good.
That could be it.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying, not to get too off topic, the Laura thing is interesting because I feel like it works much better if seen sort of in the order of the or if sort of conceived in the order of the show itself versus like the supposed chronology. Because if it's just like, okay, yeah, Laura started off as this deity and then we see her as the girl, but she was always this like, you know, messiah figure or whatever, then it does kind of like cheapen the character somewhat. But for whatever reason, like when I saw it, I almost kind of saw it as like a ex post facto or whatever sort of thing, where it was like a reaction to sort of what the character had undergone in the story and the role she played. And so it feels almost like the story doing kind of what the giant slash fireman does in, you know, within that anecdote of taking somebody who's already existed and who's already struggling and then giving them that sort of like larger than life role, or recognizing that larger than life role or something, if that makes any sense. I don't know.
Yeah, I like that a lot more than the idea that Laura was a cosmic plant from the beginning. We've talked about this a little before, but, you know, the story of Fire Walk With Me, I think, is so powerful, and it imbues Laura's trauma with so much humanity, and it's such a human story that I was really afraid that by kind of, you know, taking Laura out of the context of, you know, being a girl and growing up, taking her out of that context and making her a deity, I really thought was kind of, you know, taking away a lot of what I enjoyed about Fire Walk With Me and what I think of as the humanity of the series. So put in that context, like you were saying, Joel, I find that much more palatable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that sort of weird thing. And it's almost the same thing with Fire Walk With Me itself, how it's before Twin Peaks. But there's a certain power to it being after, of like, okay, you've heard all this, now we're going to go like deeper into that sort of thing. And actually, that's not to take over your role for a second, Matt, but that's kind of a good segue into the next scene and mm-hmm. how that sort of plays with the Palmer mythos, I think.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is a good segue to what Ashley here has typed into the notes is the best scene ever. And yeah, it's really good. Grace Zabriskie is putting in an amazing performance. And I don't want to let this go unsaid, but it also seals the deal that bad men in Twin Peaks drink Rainier beer. Just want to call that out explicitly. Rainier is the beer that they're drinking at the Pink Room in Fire Walk With Me.
Oh, wow. Good connection. Yeah.
I wonder, I mean, they have a fully stocked, I think... Ashley, you and I, if this was filmed in North Bend, I think we might have actually gone by the location that they put the neon up for the, what is it, Elks Point, Elks Number 9 Point.
You're right.
But
okay, before we get too deep into this, can I tell you something else that I remember from our trip to North Bend literally just today?
Yeah.
But I was talking to a security guard when we were watching that scene from last week being filmed, and I remember him telling me that there was this trailer in the woods that was being guarded as part of the production, and I kept expecting it to come back in a sort of Fire Walk With Me abandoned train car spooky way, but it just dawned on me that it is 100% the trailer that Dr. Ant broadcasts out of.
That's, oh my gosh, yeah, that makes sense. I do remember that exchange now. It's just like,
right.
It's just like Gordon and Albert remembering. No, all right. So anyway, beer nerd stuff,
more details from our trip come back to
beer
us.
Beer nerd stuff over. It's the same beer in Fire Walk With Me in here. It's either intentional or it isn't. Doesn't matter. We've got the embodiment of creepy, awful misogyny, and entitlement in, I don't even know if this character got a name. But he's got a truck you shirt.
He does, yeah.
And he's really aggressive towards Sarah Palmer. And then, holy shit, just everything after he starts talking is the best scene ever.
Yeah, this is a great Grace Zabriskie performance. This is a great commentary on catcalling and men making women uncomfortable in public spaces. I do think it's interesting that he repeatedly refers to her as, well, once she turns him down, he refers to her as a dyke and kind of taunts her by implying that she's a lesbian. Just, we have so few queer characters. Queerness is so infrequently mentioned in this show that it really stuck out to me. But then she opens her face up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was wild.
So what we see is black and white, like the space with the fireman, and we see the creepy wide smile, and we also see a hand with a darkened ring finger, and as we know from Gordon earlier, the ring finger is the spiritual finger. And she's saying, do you really want to fuck with this?
And then puts her face back and bites his neck off.
Yeah.
I love how quick it is, and I mean, just so it does seem for a moment like Sarah reacts, and it seems like for a moment you're wondering if Sarah was momentarily possessed in a way, but then right after the words talking to the bartender who comes over, Grace goes right back to that like icy I don't give a fuck way, and the bartender backs off too. So it's I mean, if there is a question of Sarah being in control versus another entity, it's very back and forth, or it's just the entity putting on an act.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of all that. I mean, I have so first of all, before I kind of bring up that thought, I had like I said, I had a couple scattered thoughts. One of them was we were talking about Top of the Lake, and that just made me think of like there's a scene a lot like this, not to the supernatural level, but like there's a similarly like constructed scene in Top of the Lake where she's being taunted in a bar. I think there's two mm-hmm. scenes actually, because there's one where she like throws the dart at someone, and then there's another one
yes.
where she like smashes them on the head with a bottle or something. So that just totally
yes,
I don't...
and they call her a dyke in both
okay,
of those scenes.
Okay, yeah, wow, interesting. And then the other thing was just well, first of all, Lynch must hate truckers because all the truckers in his movies are just like terrible, or in Twin Peaks. But there was another. Oh yeah, I'm 100% sure this isn't the case, or 99.9. But it would be wild if that guy was actually like one of the actors from the. Pink room scene, just like aged 20 years or something. Like,
I
don't think he really looks like either of them, but it would be wild if you brought that actor back just for that.
It definitely would.
And so then the other thing was just, yeah, the thing that I don't quite know what to make of it. Like, I love this scene. It was just visually so cool and such a cool idea. I don't know yet what to make of Sarah's condition and like how it impacts who she was as a character, who like the Palmers were, like what's going on. Like it's one of the areas in the new Twin Peaks that I'm like fascinated by, but also really have like no grasp on sort of how to fit it into what we already have, or even if I'll ultimately be glad that it exists, you know, like I can't really make any judgment on it until I kind of see everything they're doing with it. And where that's going, you know what I mean? I don't know how you guys felt about that or what.
Yeah, I read the AV Club recap today when I was trying to kind of gather my notes, and they in the AV Club did draw a connection between the bug crawling in the girl's mouth in part 8 and Sarah in this part, because you know, it seems like she would be the right age to be that girl, you know, kind of the aesthetics of the black and white there. I don't know that I totally buy it, but I think that that could be an interesting connection. And regardless, I just love what they're doing with Sarah. With as little as we've seen of her, Grace has given an amazing performance, and she's by far one of the most interesting characters on a very interesting show.
Definitely. Sarah, rather than being, you know, called upon to scream and be a conduit, Sarah just killed someone. So Sarah's doing things in the return, and moving plot along and giving us some moments. I am not willing to rule out the bug, the frog moth.
Yeah, me either.
Theory.
I kind of like that idea, honestly.
But I also like the idea of. Sarah has always been vulnerable as a conduit to at least receiving messages and signs that seem to be coming from sort of the lodge planes and so forth. And we see her dealing with, you know, the life she has now through, you know, alcoholism and making herself Bloody Marys, going to the bar when she runs out. Like it's a sad thing. And I would also be open to a version of this story where this is something that Sarah, not to say that she allowed happen to her in the last 25 years, but that happened as a result of losing Laura and dealing with grappling with Leland. Yeah. But if it's the frog moth, I just hope that it's expanded upon more. I don't want it to be a loose connection like that.
Yeah, I fully agree.
I think we're clearly going to get, we're being set up for something more with Sarah, but I almost do feel like it'll be one of the corners of the narrative where we learn more, but we ultimately don't get like a total explanation for everything, which I think I'd be fine with. But it would definitely leave me with a lot to kind of ponder.
Yeah. I just would like to see this storyline retain Sarah's agency. I want to see her be totally in control of taking her face off and, you know, cultivating that ability in whatever way that, you know, she does.
She's also very, like, whatever the adjective form of vampire is, like, very vampire.
Vampiric?
Yeah. Because there's so much involving, I mean, there's a lot involving blood on the show in general, but like specifically with her, like she drinks the Bloody Marys. She's watching the boxing, and then she's watching the lions tear apart the animal. And then she takes this guy's, you know, blood and everything. So there's something going on there. I don't know what.
Yeah. I wonder if it's less vampiric and more primal, more this idea that she's kind of returned to this base or primal or animalistic way of being as a result of being stripped of those familial relationships that kind of hold you in place in society. Mm.
Another thing we should mention is in the last week since part 13, I think this was talked about most on the Twin Peaks Reddit, that someone timed out the boxing loop that Sarah watches in the previous part and says that it times itself lines pretty well up with the loop of the woodsman in part 8, saying that sort of poem over and over again. This is the water, this is the well. And Sarah, of course, saying like the appearance before that men are coming. I definitely feel like there's going to be some connection between whatever has happened to Sarah Palmer or whatever Sarah Palmer has been, and the woodsman.
Mm. I just had a thought. It's the first time, at least since we've seen this part and the Monica Bellucci dream, makes me wonder if, I don't know that there literally will be a character dreaming. I don't think it'll be as close to the mark as it was with like Mulholland Drive, because that would be kind of repeating himself somewhat. But if there is a character who's, if there was any character who could be identified as kind of dreaming it, I thought, well, that's got to be Laura. But what if it was Sarah? You know, we see her as sleeping, if that's her, as a little girl, sleeping with the frog kind of climbed in, and it's like you get this sense that she's dreaming something, and I don't know. I that's a cool idea to me. I like that.
I like that a lot.
She could be kind of the dreamer, you know?
And then we pan over and there's Tommy Westfall in his snow globe. Well, I guess that brings us to the Roadhouse, where I think last time we were at the Roadhouse, and Ashley, you and I are talking about this, I was like, I'm not invested in the Sparkle stuff. I'm not invested in these little conversations. And then sure enough, this conversation invokes Billy and Tina and Sparkle all at once, and I'm going, okay, I hope this is building towards something, because now I interpret it as being in direct relation to whatever's up with Audrey.
I really liked this scene.
Yeah, this is, yeah, I mean, I usually like these scenes. I'm not a hater, but
I'm the hater, yeah.
We do get kind of the other side of the story that Audrey was told about Billy's last known whereabouts. Did you guys catch that David Lynch's wife is in this scene?
Oh, is she one of the actresses?
Yeah, she's the girl, the actress with the shorter hair.
She's in Inland Empire too, I think, and she looked familiar,
yes.
And I couldn't place her. That's okay. Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know it as I watched, but yeah, I found that fact out later as I was going through the cast list for this episode. Yeah, I like how oh gosh, I like the long pause before the other girl sitting at the table says her mom's name is Tina, and then the ominous music kicks in right after that.
Oh, that was so good. That, more than anything, I think, was like the vibes I would get from watching Lynch films for the first time. Like, that you kind of, like, you still get certain things from them, but you don't get that, like, initial feeling of dread and excitement and, like, oh my God, they're in Club Silencio, what's going to happen? Or, you know, Fred Madison's out in the desert, oh my God, what's going to, like, that little moment was, like, the most like that for me, I think, of anything in the show so far. Just like, oh no, where is it? What's about to happen, you know? Like, it, and I heard some people suggest they thought she was lying, which I don't know if I buy that, but they thought, somebody on Twitter, I can't attribute it because I can't remember. I'll see if I can find it. But basically saying they thought she was actually Audrey's daughter, and she was, and it's Linda, of like Richard and Linda that they mentioned.
Oh, right. Oh, fuck.
And that, like, maybe that was it, and she was lying about Tina being her mom. I don't know why she would, but that's interesting.
She could plausibly be Audrey's daughter. Looks, I don't know.
Plausible. I think what I took out of that scene more was that the other character, the one played by David's wife, is unusually invested in dragging that story out of Tina's daughter. Yeah, she's like plying for information in a very specific way.
What has Billy been up to?
I mean, he's not well.
Bleeding profusely. Maybe he had a run-in with Sarah. Well, one of the things that I really liked about the scene was just like the way she was like doing this detailed description of something where it's like you can almost visualize it, but you're not seeing it. It was I couldn't come up with what it was when I was like writing about it the other night, but I realize now there's like a bunch of Lynch scenes like that. There's like all of Laura Dern's whole monologue in Inland Empire where she just goes on for like 20 minutes of like, you know, I punched him, I ripped out his eyeball or something. She's like going into all this detail. And then there's like the Laura Dern in Blue Velvet where she's talking about the Robin's dream. And she's like describing it and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's one other scene. Oh, I know. Lynch's song Crazy Clown Time. Which is actually, it's funny because it's an example of that, and it's also an example of like really explicitly showing stuff, because the song is like one long 6-minute description of like these people at a party and like lighting their hair on fire and pouring beer on each other and all this stuff, and it's like sort of like a Pink Room drony kind of beat, and he's just describing this whole thing. But the funny thing is, then he made a music video in which he literally shows everything they're talking about, like people running around, like lighting their mohawk on fire. It's like literally just an illustration of the lyrics, so it's kind of funny. But for some reason, yeah, that made me really think of all that stuff, where he's really good at like showing stuff, but he's also really good at describing stuff.
Any other thoughts?
I feel like we covered everything very thoroughly. This episode felt like it had a lot more momentum, and at points when I was watching the episode, I was worried that it was ultimately going to feel rushed, but looking back, I don't get the sense that it was rushed, but it definitely was unusually quickly paced for what we've seen from The Return so far.
I think the quickest paced one was probably, I think it was part 11, where it starts off with like all the stuff with like Becky and the woman crawling. Like that one really felt like super fast paced to me. And then some of them obviously much slower. Mm-hmm. And then this one was kind of like, this one felt like kind of in the middle to me. I felt like it did something a lot of the episodes have been doing, where they start with a very sort of Frostian kind of exposition scene with the FBI, and then they end with like a really enigmatic roadhouse scene, and like in between you kind of move from one mode to the other, like it's almost organized that way, it feels like, which is just really interesting.
Yeah, that's very true. I think maybe the sense of rush pace or whatever that I'm getting is maybe that some of the events, as important as they are, seem to happen without impetus. Like we talked about, why is, you know, Truman calling Gordon just now about the pages in the diary are, why is this call happening now? We talked about the fact that we don't really know why Chad's being arrested. We just know that he is. I think that might be what's causing that feeling for me. But at the same time, like, there are so many connections finally being made between plots. Like, there's almost this triangulation happening between Buckhorn, Twin Peaks, and the Pink Place, or this extra, I don't know, extraterrestrial level, to kind of this plane that we're working on, whatever we want to call it. Things have almost conjoined with the exception of Las Vegas. But Buckhorn also has that connection too now, so we're kind of tenuously bringing everything together.
Got 4 hours left.
I think is it three or four? I don't know how many storylines you could organize at this point, but I feel like this week sort of connected them all.
Yeah, I think the missing link is Twin Peaks to Las Vegas.
Right, other than the key.
Yes.
That they mailed. That's kind of a...
Although...
They haven't done much with it yet.
Yeah, I don't know that Ben has kind of traced back the origins of the key.
Yeah.
Yeah, the key is just enticing at this point. But, that was part 14. It was a blast. And, I mean, it answered some questions. It raised some questions a lot. And thank you, Joel, for being here to talk about all of it with us. Would you like to do your final round of plugs? Anything that we haven't mentioned so far? Your website, lostinthemovies.com, and Twitter, @lostinthemovies. Anything else?
I'm on Tumblr, too. And actually, you guys are the reason I'm on there,
because
you were doing some episode, and I wanted to ask a question, and that was, like, the forum to do it. So I set up a Tumblr, and then I just, like, kept tumbling, I guess. So it's still going. It's most at this point. It's kind of slowed down. Like it's mostly just this exercise I did a few years ago, where I'm doing it each day. It's like all the short films and music videos and features and you actually random YouTube videos that were on like lists and stuff that I watched in a single year, and I did them. I put them all in chronological order. So each day you get it's like a screen cap from a different movie, and it's up to like 2012 now or something. So after that ends, I gotta come up with a new routine, because I used to put up a lot of Twin Peaks pictures and stuff, but with so much other stuff going on, it just kind of got distracting. But the only other thing I'd say is of the videos, if somebody wants to sample them, especially after this week's episode, check out like chapters 23 through 25, which are Fire Walk With Me ones, and they touch on a little bit some of the Hindu stuff with the Upanishads, which I'm sorry if anybody's out there listening and I'm mispronouncing, but it kind of ties that in, so they might find that interesting.
Awesome. Thanks again, and now I guess I'll do my plugs. I'm Matthew Olson. You can find me on Twitter. It's @MatthewOlson. Please spell it right. A shocking announcement. It's not the return of my other regular podcast, Can You Get to That, which I make with my friend Caitlin Best. It's a Wikipedia podcast, which is also why, Joel, when you brought up the Wikipedia page earlier, I was never going to tell you not to. Because
nice.
That's like the whole show where all we do is talk about Wikipedia pages. But it's not that show. We don't have a new episode for that at this time. But I did just record this week a year retrospective check-in on my short-lived show Finite Jest, where my friend Alex Clute and I read Infinite Jest in 6 weeks. I feel like I should say that Finite Jest is kind of a joke. I feel like I'm always sincere on this show, especially during Drape Runner Corner. Whereas Finite Jest is we did read the book. We did discuss the book often in earnest, but we go off the rails a bunch and kind of do a heightened version of ourselves. And we decided to dip back into that well a year later to see what we remember about the book, what we took away from the book. We talk a lot about LCD Sound System. So that'll be up this week too, if you want to start either with listening to us talk about the David Foster Wallace novel, or listen to us just take the piss out of it and waste 2 hours of your time. So you can find that. It's Finite Jest on iTunes, finitejest.simplecast.fm. There's not a Twitter for it because we made 6 episodes of the thing. 7 now. That's it. Ashley?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Ashley Brandt. You can also listen to my other podcast, The K-Hole, a Kardashian podcast. Most recently, we covered the first 2 episodes of Life of Kylie. I had a really fun Kylie Jenner expert as a guest for that episode. We had a lot of fun talking about kind of the sad state of that show and what it kind of says about Kylie's life and Gen Z stuff. And I had a lot of fun making it, so you guys should listen. We're also going to be covering season 14 of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which is debuting in October. And if you are ever marathoning that series, we have 42 episodes of Kardashian commentary for you. So check out the K-Hole.
Have at it, yeah. And then one last shout out, of course, to Cole Hamilton, who made our wonderful podcast cover art. You can find Cole on Twitter. He's at CFarEnough. And you can go to his personal website to check out his work, both Twin Peaks and not Twin Peaks. You can carve it up into many buckets. I just saw he put up some art that he did of characters from Marvel's The Defenders, which was really excellent. So check out all of Cole's art at his website. That's ColeHamilton.com. ColeHamilton.com.
Can I throw in one last shout out too?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I found the person who, it was actually a comment on my blog, the one who came up with the Richard Linda idea about the girl being Linda and lying about Audrey being her mom at the Roadhouse. It was Michelle Tackerberry. She's a commentator on my blog, so I just wanted to give credit where it's due.
Credit where it's due, yeah. Awesome. So that's been us on part 14. Ashley, take it away.
This has been Twin Peaks. Do you really want to fuck with this?